Thank you, and may it please the court. Mr. Moss is entitled to resentencing in this case because he meets the four prongs of this court's Wheeler test. The government already concedes the first and third prongs, that Mijas foreclosed any claim at the time of his sentencing, and that Mr. Moss cannot rely on a successive 2255 petition. Additionally, the government concedes at least part of prong two, waiving any discussion of Clark's retroactivity. Additionally, Mr. Moss meets the other part of prong two and prong four, that Clark represents a change in the substantive law of the 11th Circuit, and that Mr. Moss's sentence is fundamentally defective. Finally, the government waives any discussion of the equitability principles in habeas that compel relief. Accordingly, we are asking this court to reverse and remand for resentencing. Turning to prong two, Clark, the 11th Circuit case that held an adjudication withheld conviction under the federal felon in possession statute, has effectively overruled the rationale upholding Mijas. Mijas is the case of the 11th Circuit that held an adjudication withheld qualifies as a conviction under the 841 and 851 enhancements that are stymieing Mr. Moss here. Mijas, effectively, is bad law, which is...
Let me just stop you there, because what does that mean, that it's effectively bad law? The 11th Circuit hasn't overruled it, right?
Correct, Your Honor, it has not. However, it is bad law because the entire rationale, the entire holding of Mijas has been effectively overruled by the 11th Circuit decision in Clark.
Let me bracket that for a minute, but... Even assuming that's correct, and this is going to sound so semantic, I guess, but I feel like our savings clause law is like that. Is it your position that it's enough that the 11th Circuit might want to go back and reconsider Meha in light of Clark, or is it your position that it already has done that? Do you know what I'm saying? Like, I could see an argument, certainly, that to synthesize its law, the 11th Circuit might want to take another look at how all of this stuff lines up. But is that sufficient for you to prevail?
Your Honor, under this court's Wheeler test under Step 2, it is enough to prove that there has been a change in substance of law. To the extent the 11th Circuit can be the only circuit which definitively rules it as law, that is true. But the principles here under Step 2 of Wheeler dictate that at a minimum, it should be remanded for the 11th Circuit to decide that.
I'm sorry, we should remand it to the 11th Circuit?
Remand it to the district court with a grant to transfer to the Middle District of Florida, the sentencing court, and if there are issues there, it could go on appeal to the 11th Circuit.
By what procedural vehicle would we do that?
Your Honor, there have been, habeas at its core is an equitable remedy, and there are past examples we pointed to in our brief of cases where other federal courts have ordered a transfer to redistricting to the sentencing court to allow resentencing.
Well, let me ask you about the question about whether Mijas has been overruled. Didn't the court, the 11th Circuit and Clark, in a subsequent, albeit unpublished opinion, suggest that Mijas remained good law?
Your Honor, I believe you're referring to Clark 2, which came out right on the same day as Clark. The issue with Clark 2 is, to your first point, it is unpublished, and as such, it has no precedential value in the 11th Circuit or any circuit. But second, Clark 2 came out on the same day as Clark. So in that case, defendant Clark raised an INA-based argument that he had not raised previously at trial, so he had waived that argument at trial. Thus, the court in Clark 2 is looking at a plain error view, which is a different and more difficult standard to meet. He also did not, coming out on the same day as Clark, that defendant did not have the benefit of Clark's decision, which has effectively overruled Mijas.
Well, go ahead.
No, you go.
When you say this whole thing has fallen down like a house of cards because of Clark, I mean, what you're suggesting is because some earlier opinions relied on a different opinion in a different case, that by itself just collapses the whole house of cards. But ultimately, aren't we talking about two separate statutory definitions of what to look for in terms of what makes out a conviction, one arising under federal law, one arising under state law? And why can't those two coexist under the 11th Circuit's precedents?
Your Honor, Mr. Moss has never disputed that the enhancements, 841, 851 enhancements, look to federal law. They do. But the only source of federal law they look to is Mijas. And Mijas' sole holding, its sole rationale, analogized to that state federal felon in possession statute, which was overturned in Clark.
No, Mijas actually distinguishes the two, because it notes that there are these district court holdings that say that this kind of Florida plea is not a conviction for the felon in possession statute. And then it says, but we can distinguish those because that's a matter of, I'm going to get it mixed up, that's a matter of state law, right? Whereas this question in front of us is a matter of federal law. So it actually does divide the world. And the distinction that Judge Diaz is talking about is already baked into 11th Circuit law.
It is, Your Honor. However, the court in Mijas, the 11th Circuit, only looked to those felon in possession statutes as its sole rationale for its holding. It analogized specifically to those.
No, it didn't. It distinguished those. I don't know. Are you talking about Jones, Eddie Jones? Because maybe Mijas.
Yes, Your Honor. That's what I meant. Mijas relied exclusively on
Eddie Jones.
Yes.
Right. But I'm saying at the same time it did that, it also did distinguish 922 as a separate context. And that's where, so that's why I'm having trouble with this argument that the entire edifice of the case law here has disappeared, because already in Mijas it was making this distinction.
I'm not sure I'm entirely following, Your Honor.
The court was saying, if you 841, you look to federal law, mm-hmm. right? And it says 922G, you look to state. But we think the state is in sync with the federal. We now know that's wrong, but that doesn't change the first half of it, that you look to federal, and that law hasn't changed.
It hasn't, Your Honor. However, the federal law only looks to Eddie Jones relying on those felon in possession statutes.
Jones was almost, frankly, an afterthought in Mejias. I mean, it just trotted that out as an example, and yet another example as to why Mejias was correct. But I don't think it relied solely on that. Is that what you're saying?
It is, Your Honor. It is the sole holding that it pinned it on. The government points to in its brief other policy rationales that may hold, but those are not what Mejias put its sole holding upon. So while the 11th Circuit could, in theory, change that is not at issue here today. Only the 11th Circuit could change that determination. Mejias, in fact, put its sole rationale on Eddie Jones, which relied exclusively on the felon in possession statutes, two of which had previously been overturned, Buscatani and Garcia, and the third, Grigan, which was specifically overturned by the 11th Circuit clerk.
I mean, Mejias... Part of the analysis says the meaning of the word conviction in a federal statute is a question of federal law unless Congress provides otherwise, and it cites to Dickerson, a Supreme Court case. I mean, that by itself seems to stand alone as a rationale for why your case is different. And then Jones was sort of discussed as an example, which is the Chief Judge says back then was consistent with Mejias, but now the Florida Supreme Court has told us otherwise. But I don't see how those are at all inconsistent.
Your Honor, I come back to that Mejias, the court in the 11th Circuit in Mejias still put its sole holding, at least, upon Eddie Jones. It may have mentioned other attributes, other policy considerations, but its sole holding was on the rationale of analogizing to the felon possession statutes under Eddie Jones. Additionally, Your Honor, because of that, Mejias has been effectively returned. Again, to satisfy step two, prong two of Wheeler in this court, it must be enough to show that there has been a change in the law. Mejias is arguably bad law. While it seems here that there may be other justifications potentially the 11th Circuit could do or could have held for Mejias, it frankly just didn't for its holding. And so at a minimum, that is enough, in addition with the equitability principles under habeas, enough at a minimum where this court may have some doubt to send it back to the sentencing court and on appeal to the 11th Circuit. Additionally, under prong four, it is clear that Mr. Moss has suffered a fundamental defect, a harm, as a result of his doubled mandatory minimums, similar to the instance that Mr. Wheeler suffered in this case just last year. And so as a result of that, his sentence went from 10 years to 20 years. It literally doubled the amount of time that Mr. Moss is serving as a result of the mandatory minimum, as a result of the adjudication withheld in 2004.
But there's also, right, a concurrent 20-year sentence for the firearm charges. Is that right?
There is, Your Honor. However, the sentencing court never gave an independent rationale as to why it gave 240 months for count two for the gun charges. And that alone, under U.S. v. Livesay, is enough to mandate remand for resentencing, because the sentencing judge did not give an independent rationale, and we are led to believe that there may have been an influence by the sentence that he served for counts one and nine for the drug charges as to count two for the firearms.
So you're saying it may be that the firearm sentence is not truly independent of the...
Yes, Your Honor.
Government. Okay. Can I ask you, you skipped to prong four, and I understand that you think the government has waived the retroactivity question, but... Why, assuming for a minute that Mejias is no longer good law, Why is that change? How has that change been deemed retroactive?
Sure, Your Honor. So under Teague, under the Teague analysis, there is a Clark has announced a new substantive rule because it has narrowed the range of conduct that Mr. Moss would be harmed by. His adjudication withheld would not qualify as a conviction under Clark because Clark has more broadly overruled Mijas, and as a result, it would change his qualification under that 841B1 enhancement. So it narrows the range of the punishment he would otherwise face.
So you're saying that any change in the law that affects sentencing is substantive?
If it narrows the scope of the conduct, of what would...
That would drop a guideline range.
Yes,
Your Honor. That makes it substantive.
Yes.
And what's the authority for that?
Under Teague, it would qualify simply because it alters that range of conduct that is punishable. So it qualifies under the exception for new substantive rules. And, Your Honor, further to that point about the gun charge, I mean, the evidence in the record is tenuous at best as to whether Mr. Moss actually used any firearms in connection, so the sentencing judge's failure there to provide an independent rationale is deeply concerning. Because that whole sentence can be reviewed, it should ultimately be remanded to the district court with instructions to transfer to the sentencing court in the Middle District of Florida. And finally, equitable principles in this case compel habeas relief. To the extent this court may be concerned or unsure or unwilling to try to parse together what is admittedly the difficult substantive law of the 11th Circuit, the equitable principles, the broad powers that federal courts have, should compel habeas relief in this case. The harm is suffered by Mr. Moss as he continues to suffer what is potentially an erroneously enhanced sentence that has doubled his mandatory minimums. And because of that, any certainty or ambiguity should be cast in favor of him, especially under this court's Wheeler test. In closing, Mr. Moss has met all four conditions of the Wheeler test. Mijas, as the government acknowledges on prong one, has initially rendered a sentence lawful at the time, so it was unavailable to him. Second point, that the government has conceded retroactivity, so there's retroactive effect through Clark. Clark represents a change in the substantive law. Mr. Moss is otherwise unable to seek relief through successive 2255 petition because it's a statutory change. And his enhanced sentence under prong four represents an error that is fundamentally a fundamental defect. And as a result, he meets all four prongs of this court's Wheeler test.
Yeah, there's a question before you sit down, Mr. Neal. You suggest that we'd send this case to the 11th Circuit, right?
Your Honor, we're suggesting that this be remanded to the district court with instructions
Ultimately, you wanted to go to 11th Circuit, correct?
If it needs to overrule Mijas, yes.
I have some great colleagues and friends in 11th Circuit, but you don't think the 4th Circuit is able to do the work?
Your Honor, it's not that the Fourth Circuit is certainly incapable of interpreting that, but because the substantive flaw is in the 11th Circuit, the Fourth Circuit here is interpreting whether Mr. Moss meets the Wheeler test that this court has set forth.
I understand that, but the question is whether or not the deferred adjudication would constitute a conviction, right?
It does, but under Mijas, under the 11th Circuit substantive law. So only the 11th Circuit could definitively say that. Here, the Fourth Circuit could certainly find, as we are noting, that it is bad law.
You suggested perhaps the answer is it should be with state law, not federal law.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right, that's your position. Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Okereke?
May it please the court, Amy Okereke for the United States. The issue at hand here, I believe, Your Honors, is settled. The 11th Circuit has settled this matter, the circuit has settled this matter, and Clark has changed nothing. The 11th Circuit has said you look to federal law when determining what a conviction is under a federal statute, specifically the federal enhancement statute, 851 and 841. This court has said you look to federal law. And Clark 1, that petitioner hangs its hat on, is specific to the felon in possession statute, which is different because it looks to state law. And I believe what is significant in this case, as this court alluded to, on the very same day that the 11th Circuit issued Clark 1, it issued Clark 2. And yes, Clark 2 is an unpublished decision, but that does not render it unimportant for purposes of what we're looking at here today. And I'd like to note two key points of what the Clark 2 court stated. And first, I'd like to just highlight that Clark 2, again, was issued on the same day in the same case relating to the same defendants and by the same panel. And in Clark 2, specifically when assessing whether or not it was plain error to hold that enhancement could be held under 851 and 841, the court reaffirmed its precedent in Mejias, stating that we clearly do not have anything, any precedent of this court, because specifically the Clark 2 case dealt with a suspended sentence, whereas Mejias dealt with a withheld adjudication where there was some sentence that took place after. But the court specifically reaffirmed Mejias, stating, our precedent suggests opposite. In Mejias, we held that Mejias's prior plea of nolo contendere with adjudication withheld in Florida State Court is a conviction that supports an enhanced sentence under Section 841B. And if it was not unambiguous what the 11th Circuit intended, it went even further. And I direct the court to footnote 8 of Clark 2. In footnote 8, the court further reaffirms that the questions addressed in Clark 1 were different than Clark 2 by stating that the question, referring to the 851 enhancement that we are dealing with in this case, is different from the one that the defendant raised regarding his Section 922G gun charge, and that's Clark 1. The court further went on to say, for 922G, we look to whether Florida state law treats a prior arrest as a conviction. Here, and referring to the 841-851 enhancement, the court then states, again citing to Mejias, we look to federal law. And therein is the crux of this matter. Clark 1 dealt specifically with a narrow issue. It was a certified question to the Florida State Supreme Court on the issue of whether a conviction, a withheld adjudication, could be considered a conviction for purposes of the federal felon in possession statute. Mejias is a separate issue, and again, Mejias looked to federal law as opposed to state law. So petitioner dismisses, again, the 11th Circuit's clear statements by stating that Clark 2 is unpublished. But what I'd like to highlight for the court is that courts act in ways that matter, and courts act in ways that make sense. And for the 11th Circuit, notwithstanding in an unpublished decision, in the one breath, to hold that Mejias is good law, or I should say specifically to rely on Mejias in finding that no plain error occurred by the district court, and then in another breath on the same day to hold for Clark that 922G somehow overruled Mejias' holding would not make sense, and furthermore would be inequitable to the defendants in both Clark 1 and Clark 2. And as I highlighted, they're the same defendants. So confronted with these two decisions, the petitioner instead has tried to come up with other arguments distinguishing why Clark 1 perhaps may have changed the landscape of 11th Circuit law and why Mejias is overruled. But if Eddie Jones, which this court mentioned, Eddie Jones perhaps was an afterthought in the Mejias decision. If Eddie Jones is the sole basis upon which petitioner can rely on that Mejias is no longer good law, then petitioner truly has quite a battle to make that argument. As this court recognized, Mejias cites to Eddie Jones. However, it cites to Eddie Jones in a parenthetical and for Eddie Jones holding that for purposes of the career offender provisions, that a withheld adjudication will be considered a conviction. Mejias separately, as this court noted, distinguished the federal firearm statute and 922G when stating that those provisions relate to state law, and separately what we are deciding here is a matter of first impression, which deals with whether or not we should consider state or federal law in determining what a conviction is for purposes of the withheld, or excuse me, for purposes of 841 and 851. So clearly in Mejias, the court makes a distinction between whether to use federal and state law, and that truly was the sole basis or the fundamental basis of what Mejia stood for, and it relied on Annie Jones as just another example of where the court had found a withheld adjudication to be considered a conviction. And what I'd also like to note is the fundamental differences between 922G as well as 21 U.S.C. 841 and 851. 841 and 851, this is a recidivist enhancement, and the purposes for using a conviction arguably are different than with 922G, and that's something that the Florida Supreme Court highlighted in its certified question when answering the 11th Circuit's question. The Florida Supreme Court specifically stated that while we find here, as to the federal felon in possession statute, that a withheld adjudication is not considered a conviction, there are other circumstances where, based on the text, rationale, and reasoning of those statutes, that a withheld adjudication should be considered a conviction. And the policy reasons behind 841 and 851 are just those. So we have a situation here where adjudication was withheld on petitioner's prior felony drug Florida state conviction. However, petitioner did engage further in criminal acts, and that's part of what the enhancements address, that where an individual breaks the law, the deferred sentence may be imposed. And again, for this reason, that's why these types of sentences do not exonerate a defendant for purposes of criminal history points.
Counsel, can I ask you a question about retroactivity?
Yes.
I understand that, you think that that's not raised in this case because there was no change in the law, but just sort of hypothetically, I'm trying to get my hands around whether this is a substantive or procedural rule for Teague purposes, and your colleague is arguing it's a substantive rule. I know I'm asking you to imagine something that you don't agree with, but if we were to imagine that Clark 1 changed the law, even as to the enhancement here, would you agree that as applied to the felon in possession statute, that Clark 1 is a substantive rule? Because if you're not a felon, you didn't do anything wrong?
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, as the court has alluded to, the government did not address this point because it's, we believe, totally inapplicable to this setting. But I do concede that if faced with a situation where it was the felon in possession statute specifically, and as well faced with the specific conviction withheld under Florida state law, we may be dealing with a different scenario, and retroactivity may apply with the substance of that decision.
Okay.
However,
we're
not faced with that issue in this case, which again is why the government did not focus
on that. So you would draw a distinction and say that it might be substantive as applied to to the felon in possession statute, but would you say it's not substantive if it applied to just a sentencing enhancement?
That's correct.
Okay, I just wanted to get the government's position on this. All right.
Yes, Your Honor. And as the court alluded to, let me jump to my other argument with regard to the gun charge that was issued, which, as the government has submitted, is an independent justification for why the petitioner's sentence stands. The petitioner was sentenced, in addition to his drug charges, to 240 months for a gun charge. And I call it a gun charge, but it's a charge that involved well over 7 different guns. These were Glocks, pistols, revolvers. And the petitioner states that the sentencing court gave no independent rationale for anything related to this gun charge. But that's not correct. During sentencing, the district court judge placed heavy emphasis on the effect of guns in the drug distribution network that the petitioner was involved in, as well as the fact that one of the guns that was involved in this conspiracy potentially could have led to the death of a police lieutenant. And specifically, I direct the court's attention to the joint appendix at page 101. I'm sorry, that's at page 79, excuse me. Now, the court, talking to the petitioner's family, states, "I'm sorry you were not here for this 3-week trial because it may have opened up your eyes to the distribution in which he was involved actively. The conspiracy with other people, the kidnapping that was occurring, the use of firearms, including the use of a firearm that could have easily killed a law enforcement officer by one of the co-defendants. So this was not a court that was silent as to why she was issuing a sentence of at the maximum for the gun charge. This is a court that very clearly gave her reasons. And the court furthermore highlighted the defendant's involvement in the criminal drug conspiracy that he was convicted of. The court went further and stated, I'm now at Joint Appendix at 102, 101 to 102. The court stated, you have to realize that these are serious matters. He is not facing this time in jail because of minor offenses. He's facing them because he is indeed a danger in the community, along with all of the other people involved in this. She went, again, even further. The court, during the sentencing, chastised not only the defendant, but she went further to chastise his family to say, you could have stopped this. Where were you when all of this happened? And your family member, she continues, I'm now at page 102 of the joint appendix, the court states, there's no reason for you being here except willfulness. You willfully got together with the wrong crowd of people, and you know it, and you willfully wanted to participate in this. So these statements by the court, again, highlight the court's rationale for issuing the 240-month sentence on the gun charge. And this, I say this in contrast to the situation that we had in Wheeler. In Wheeler, when the court addressed this particular prong of whether or not a grave injustice or error occurred in the sentence or due to any alleged error, the court highlighted the words of the sentencing course in that matter. And specifically in Wheeler, the court stated that it was reluctant. The court stated that the mandatory minimum was harsh, but its hands were tied because it was confined by the mandatory minimum. We don't have any of those here. So again, I draw a stark contrast between a situation where perhaps there is some evidence in the record where the court was influenced or considered the alleged or purported error, in that case a mandatory minimum, as well as this case, to the situation we have here, where it's clear that the court was unrestrained by any mandatory minimum, and the court gave very clear reasons for her rationale. And finally, I'd like to note petitioner's so-called equitable arguments. And I believe petitioner explained the equitable arguments to be that notwithstanding Wheeler or this court's savings clause test, that this court independently as an act of equity should send this matter to the district court, the Middle District of Florida, and thereafter have the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals hear this matter if there's any issue. Well, as this court is aware, the savings clause test is a threshold inquiry of jurisdiction before even the petitioner can get to any relief and before a court can consider this. And the district court in this matter, Judge Dever, found that the petitioner had not met this inquiry and therefore dismissed the case. There is no mechanism for this court to jump through that threshold inquiry, which is the savings clause test, to remand this matter to another court. So the argument is certainly not waived because the argument of sending it to the district court, that's what the savings clause test is, and that's what the entire argument that we've been discussing is. And what I'd also like to note about petitioner's suggestion that if this court somehow felt uncomfortable deciding this issue, that the means of going through the Middle District of Florida and somehow to the 11th Circuit is an option. Even that option would not make any sense in this context. As the government laid out in its brief, the genesis of the savings clause, as well as noting the differences in how the circuits have held the savings clause and what type of relief can be allowed under the savings clause. And the court may be familiar with McCarthin v. Goodwill Industries, Suncoast. And in that matter, the 11th Circuit has categorically held that a statutory claim like the one we're dealing with here cannot be heard through savings clause relief, unlike what this court held in Wheeler. So therefore, any type of remedy that petitioner urges that would include this matter being remanded to the Middle District and somehow it would make its way to the 11th Circuit is not possible under current precedent of the 11th Circuit. So again, in addition to the equitable argument, this court having no mechanism to make its way there, it as well would not even be a viable option as the petitioner proposes. And with that, if the court has no questions, the government just seeks that this court to reaffirm the decision of the district court in dismissing the petition for a lack of jurisdiction. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Neal, you have some time reserved.
Your Honors, a few points. First, to assuage this court's concerns, Mejias only relied on federal law, that is true. But that law in turn, and the Eddie Jones decisions and its importance on the felon in possession statute, itself turn on state law. So while the government makes many points and strains to say that this is a case, these are different statutes, the felon in possession interpreting state law, the 841-851 enhancements here interpreting federal law, that federal law analogizes holding specifically to the felon in possession statutes, which are in fact state law. Second, the government made a point about Clark II, arguing that our only point on that was that it's unpublished. First, it is unpublished and as such has no precedential value. But secondly, it did not effectively say that Mejias was still good law. Clark II dealt with plain error review based on the fact that the defendant in that case, Mr. Clark, had waived any arguments at trial. And the plain error review is a different standard and a harder standard to meet.
But it seemed, just in reading the opinion, and I agree with you, it's unpublished, but in trying to make sense of what the court was doing, in reading the opinion, it seemed like the plain error thing had to do with the argument that in that case there had been a suspended sentence rather than adjudication withheld. And so that was the defendant's argument. You can distinguish Mejias based on that ground. And they said, well, not under plain error, you can't. Like, we might take another look at that if it came up directly, and maybe we could distinguish Mejias on that ground. But I didn't see anything in there suggesting that they weren't just applying Mejias as good law. And the question was this factual nuance. That's where the plain error came in.
Your Honor, to your point of that, the court in Clark II upholding Mejias on those grounds are not the same grounds here under the enhancement. The court in Clark II did not have the benefit, the defendant in that case did not have the benefit of Clark's decision, which has effectively overruled Mejias since then. To the government's point, they came out on the same day. So as a result, he did not have the benefit of...
But the court had the benefit of it because it's the same panel.
It is, Your Honor. But in that case...
It's not like they didn't know about Clark I, right?
Correct, Your Honor. But again, that plain error discussion is just a different standard and harder standard than the standard applying here. Additionally, to the point the government made on retroactivity, and to your point, Judge Harris, questioning that, when the government conceded that it would be a substantive rule for the felon in possession statute, that is an important concession. Because the felon in possession statute and the precedent under an adjudication withheld no longer qualifying as conviction after Clark is important because that is the sole holding that Mejias had. So the rationale to get from that is additionally that the government is implicitly acknowledging and conceding that it would be a new substantive rule here, that Clark would apply retroactively on collateral review. By acknowledging that it would do so in a felon in possession case, the precedent, the felon in possession precedent that Mejias solely relied on from Eddie Jones. Third point, the government makes many arguments on the gun charges. You heard them point to the joint appendix, discussion that the sentencing judge had about the family, and other testimony in the record, also arguing seven guns, the number of guns under the count to indictment. That applied to all of the defendants, not just Mr. Moss. There's scant testimony in the record that Mr. Moss ever possessed, may have temporarily possessed up to two guns, not the seven guns the government claims all of the defendants may have had at some point in time during the entire drug conspiracy. Thus, the arguments about family discussion and other points in the record are not an independent basis or rationale that the sentencing judge would have had to put forward for those 240 months. And to the final point, that the government argues that there's no mechanism here if this court found that it didn't meet the Wheeler test is just simply not true. This court, even if it found that Mr. Moss did not satisfy the Wheeler test, and again, we maintain that certainly Mr. Moss has, this court still could use a writ of quorum nopus to send it back to the 11th Circuit and find the equitable relief principles that are inherent under habeas.
Has that been pled? Has that been alleged before, or you're making that argument for the first time?
It is in our reply brief in a footnote.
But it wasn't filed before then, was it?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. However, certainly this court could construe it in an extraordinary case as we have here. It could certainly find that.
Can I also ask you a question about this equitable argument that your colleague mentioned, that in essence, she suggested be careful what you ask for, because if we were to send this case back to the 11th Circuit or the district court in Florida, their savings clause jurisprudence is different in the sense that you don't even get out of the box with respect to a claim like this in the 11th Circuit. What's your response to that?
Your Honor, that's merely an irrelevant point. The question of the savings clause test here is under this court's decision in Wheeler. It would be the sentencing court that would ultimately determine what the sentence would be and his availability on the savings clause there. But as far as this court's concerned, it's whether he can satisfy the Wheeler test.
All right.
If there are no further questions, I would like to briefly conclude arguing that Mr. Moss should have the opportunity for resentencing in the Middle District of Florida. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Neal. Before you leave the podium, I want to acknowledge it's also Mr. Roseberg as well, and the university and law school. Thank you so much for taking on this case. You're a court appointed. Appreciate the, on behalf of the Fourth Circuit, your work. It's very, very helpful for our court to administer justice, and we appreciate that. And also, counsel for the government, we appreciate your able representation of the United States. You want to break? We are going to come down and greet counsel.